Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1117. Go over to ID10T.com, sign up for the email list. Not only for fun pop culture merch stuff, but also some stand-up show dates are starting to trickle in. They're not, I wouldn't say, immediately soon, but certainly in the several months to come. So we will be sending out information about that in the not too distant future. So just sign up for the email list. Again, it's not, we don't send a ton of emails, so it's not going to overwhelm your inbox, but just stuff that we think is fun and relevant to your interests. So ID10T.com to sign up for the email list. And you can follow us on the socials. But let's talk about you, the ID10T community, like Winslow Dumain, who writes, I'm a comedian and artist out of Chicago. I'm writing because I created a new and highly horrifying art project I was hoping you'd share with your audience. I created The Tarot Restless, a uniquely horrifying deck of tarot cards set in a morbid fantasy universe. And Winslow cites Hellboy, Silent Hill, Lovecraft. So that sort of gives you the vibe of what it's about. He says, the work has been praised by extreme metal legends across the country. You can find more info and pre-order a deck of cards at winslowdumain.com, WinslowDumaine, winslowdumain.com. And events at ID10T.com for anyone else who has a thing that they want to share. But let's talk about this episode. It's Kevin Bacon, who pretty sure this is his third time coming back on, which delights me to no end that Kevin Bacon has been on the podcast three, because it's Kevin Bacon. It's freaking Kevin Bacon, and he's rad every time he's on. Just such a nice, down-to-earth dude. That makes me so happy. I honestly, like, there are many things that make me happy that I started doing a podcast 11 and a half years ago, but one of them is just people that I admire their work, and they turn out to be really cool and down to earth and pretty normal. You know, it just makes me happy. So I certainly appreciate Kevin Bacon's generosity with his time over the years and just being a super cool dude. His show, which is now in season two, City on a Hill, which is on Showtime now. So you can watch it. Go watch Kevin Bacon and City on a Hill and pretty much anything else he does. Just go watch Kevin Bacon and now listen to him, but listen to him first right here on the ID10T podcast number 1117. Let's roll the thing.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Hey, how you doing? Nice to see you too. Are you doing a crazy long press day, or is this
No. I had one other thing today, Today Show thing that we did from the house here, and that was it.
Is it going to be weird to go back and travel around and go into studios for things and travel around? Are we spoiled now? I could just go into a room in my house and I don't ever have to leave to go do this stuff anymore.
I think I think I feel two ways about it. One is that there, a lot of times there's something really, really nice about being able to just stay home and do a bunch of stuff like this. I mean, you know, we've done satellite media tours, which are essentially the same thing. I've done that before, but just going out to a studio and probably better, you know, cameras and stuff. On the other hand, you know, I've done a couple of, for the first time, a couple of live shows, and it was really nice. It was good. It was good to get out and actually be in the company of other people, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I feel like for the most part, people are really going to want to get out and make connections with other people. What do you think?
I think so too, but I think it's going to be like a hybrid version of like, you know, there are some things that I will, that I want to go out and do, but I don't necessarily feel compelled that I have to. There used to be this sense of urgency, but like, you have to go do everything. And I think it's just going to fall somewhere in between of like, yeah, you know, you might go to New York and do the Today Show to be in studio and, you know, see the crowd outside when that's allowed again. But other things like, yeah, I could probably do some other things from my house and not have to feel like I got to travel all over the place.
I've been amazed when I've been doing these Zooms, how many people have guitars. I see you got a couple of, they look like maybe, what are they, Gibsons?
That's a 63 Gibson Hummingbird.
Hummingbird, yeah.
This is a 56 Martin 0017.
56 Martin?
Yeah. And then that's a Gibson from the 30s, like an archtop that my wife got me as a Valentine's present.
Cool.
And then I have a guitar over there that's made by this company called Pre-War Guitars, and it's one of my favorite. I absolutely love it. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
No.
They basically just build guitars based on the, if I'm not mistaken, the pre-World War II Martin mold. So they like, they build guitars like they're from the 30s, and they do all the same stuff, and they're stunning. They just...
Oh, wow.
It's like, it's a new guitar, but it somehow feels broken in, and it's got an old timey sound to it. And, you know, I'm not a great guitar player, but that hasn't stopped me from trying.
Are they all based on the Martin kind of styles and shapes?
As far as I know, yeah. But if you go to their website, it's, you can see all the different ones they make. They make like a single O and a double O and a triple O and dreadnoughts and they can make them with varying degrees of like wear and tear, which normally I'm against, but actually looks really good. And they just feel really nice because this Martin I really enjoy, but because it's old, it falls out of tune really easily. And I'm always worried about like bumping it. And so to have a new old guitar has been really nice.
Nice. Nice.
Have you been playing a lot in quarantine?
Oh, you know, yeah. I mean, I play every day, but not enough. I'm not a good guitar player, and I don't think I'm really at the point where I'm about to get any better. I'm sort of old enough that that's not going to really happen. It's like the connection between my brain and my fingers is not getting any better. But I have been playing. It's been a good thing to do. Did some writing. I actually recorded a song in quarantine, and then we went and did a video of it also in quarantine, all using, you know, file sharing and stuff,
right, like
that, which is, you know, pretty easily to do these days. Well, before quarantine, you know, we made at least one record, pretty much never even seeing each other.
Wow.
And, but yeah, I've been playing a little, actually I was attached to a movie. I don't really know what's going to go out on with that, but it was attached to a movie before, pre-quarantine, where the character was a mandolin player, and I'd never picked up a mandolin. So I was kind of trying to work on that so that I would at least be good enough to fake it. But
man, mandolins, I have so much respect for mandolin players because I just look at the mandolin and all I can think of is carpal tunnel syndrome. Like the amount of, it just like when I watch people play, how crunched up their hands are and the precision and the accuracy it takes to play a mandolin is remarkable.
Yeah. It's also interesting because unless you play a lot of 12 string, you're not always used to, you know, covering two strings with one finger, you know?
And right. Oh yeah. That's the other thing too. It's the precision, but it's that double course string that you're playing too. Yeah. I think the mandolin is probably one of the harder
instruments to play. Did you get one? Did you say you were dicking around?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I try to play that every day too. I don't always play it every day, but yeah, I love it. It's, you know, I mean, anytime you go, like, and you got new, learn new chord shapes and stuff like that, that's kind of a little bit of a brain tease, but yeah, it's been fun.
I mean, it's kind of funny to hear you say, like, you know, I'm at a point where I think I'm just not going to get any better. Cause I started playing guitar 2 years ago as just a way to, like, you know, like, I had some old stand-up bits that I just wanted to turn into songs. So I started bringing it up on stage and learning to play in front of people. And now I've had a year to learn how to play. And it is a very confounding instrument because most of the time I honestly don't know what to practice. Like, I don't know. I pick it up and do a couple things and go, well, I don't know what else to do. What are you doing when you practice?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, I'll practice actual songs of mine, and then I'll practice other people's songs. And then you can go down a YouTube rabbit hole. I mean, oh my gosh, there's so many teachers on YouTube, and a lot of them are free, but then I've got others that I've signed up for, as, you know, to kind of do the course, and I'll just kind of flip through and see, you know, something that I haven't really looked at for a while, and, you know, just take these online things. I mean, I think they're really kind of remarkable. And also a lot of times you'll go in and say, well, I don't know, I want to play a certain song, and there's a lot of different interpretations of how people are playing things. And it's right. Really fun because the guys are out there and they're doing analysis based on live performances, and, you know, and they're probably zooming in on their fingers and, you know, trying to figure all that stuff out. And it's cool. You know, it's all that crazy kind of muso stuff when people just go right down the YouTube rabbit hole.
Absolutely. We're so spoiled now. Cause I was talking to my guitar teacher about, cause I've been, playing classical piano too. And I go, it's classical piano is so interesting because hundreds of years ago, the only way you could hear the song is if someone played it. And so the roadmap for the song is exactly what it's supposed to be. It tells you what the dynamics are. It gives you all the accidentals. It tells you, you know, when to play faster, louder, whatever. And so, but now we're just so spoiled because we can call up. But I almost wonder if we're too spoiled, because like you said, the YouTube rabbit holes, you can watch two videos that'll have the same stuff, where it's like 10 things every guitarist should do. And then those things will appear on 10 lists, 10 things guitar players should never do. And so it's always do. And so I find that it's tough to kind of sift through when you're a novice guitar player. Like, I don't know what's right or not. How would I know what is valid?
I mean, in popular music though, there really is no right. I mean, you could, you know, it's like, I'll give you an example. I don't know. You know, you play a D chord. Like, you think to yourself, there's only one way to play the D chord, and that's the way you play a D chord. James Taylor plays a D chord in a different way. His fingers are in a different position that I think most of us think of in a D chord. And the reason that he does it is because it enables him to do more of that stuff that he does on the D chord all the time, where he's hammering on and hammering off and, you know, on all kind of licky stuff. And it makes more sense for his fingers to be in this alternate position. And I'm sure he goes back and forth, but like there is no real right or wrong in that, you know, Keith takes off a string and, you know, sounds like that. You know what I mean? It's just like that kind of stuff is, I love the mistakes, and I love the way that people come to it, especially in, it is a big difference between that and classical music, where, you know, as you pointed out, it's a really pretty strict interpretation. As far as I know, I don't know that much about classical music, but I feel like if you decide to play a song in a different way than somebody else did, that's what makes it cool.
It is the interpretation. How do two people have the exact same roadmap and come up with two completely, you know, whether it be inversions or just different types of playing technique? What some guy made a really funny video that was about, I think he was playing like classical guitar or bass or something. He was playing something on bass classical, and and he would make mistakes. And then it was a panel of himself judging. And then he flipped to jazz guitar. And then they were like, that's the greatest thing ever. Because like all the things that were mistakes in classical music were basically for jazz were like these inspired, brilliant, you know.
Right.
So it is. It is. It is about figuring out how to embrace the mistakes too. But it's. But I do find what you say true. It's like I don't know how much better I'm going to get at this. I just don't understand. You know, it's just not linear in that way. It's like you kind of just have to be comfortable where you are.
I've been telling people for years when I play clams that it was a jazz choice. You know that. No, that was supposed to be there.
Yeah, that was it was an artistic choice. And then there are really no excuses because you either see, I go, well, I don't have big hands, but then Instagram shows you 100 videos of people that don't have big hands that are shredding, or like Django Reinhardt, who didn't have use of all of his fingers, who still managed to play these incredible song. So I guess it really is just, you know, I don't know how much time are you going to devote to learning it, and how, and when are you going to just be comfortable where you are?
Right.
Are y'all playing a show in April? You and your brother?
No, we don't have a show in April, as far as I know.
There was something on your website that said like April 2021, like in Connecticut or something.
I'm not sure. I'd have to check that. I think it's such a weird thing, as you know, in the business, in terms of like going and playing out, everyone's kind of like sort of trying to look down the road and see when it's going to be possible, you know,
right?
When it's going to be safe and when it's going to be, because it seems to change weekly in terms of like things opening up.
Yeah.
People considering lower capacity, you know, kind of things. And now with the amount of vaccine that's going on and the testing, it seems like things are kind of moving more quickly maybe than we anticipated, even, you know, a couple of months ago. So I don't know. I'm not sure.
Or do you miss it? Do you miss performing?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I do. In fact, just yesterday in this very room, here I was trying to do a little woodshedding and, I was actually just going through our set and, you know, thinking in anticipation of the possibility of playing again someday. I miss it a lot. I used to do a lot of theater when I first started out. And through the years, I've continued to. And I think that the feeling that you get from being in front of a live audience, and the feeling that you get that this one night is just a super, super special night that is not going to be the same as tomorrow night, and that this group of people and you are going to have this shared experience, is something that's just, I find it just a big part of my creative life. And it also creates butterflies, which I don't really get on a set anymore. You know, I've spent so much time, much of my life on sets, that the idea of a live show when you don't have take two, and when anything could happen and, you know, go wrong or go great, you know, is something that's just, you know, I miss it when you're playing with a band, especially. It's a great feeling. So yeah, I do miss it.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of the things that's hard to, like, when you watch a concert, you know, like if you're watching a concert on, you know, television or streaming or whatever, you can kind of appreciate it from, oh, that, you know, that looks great. Or wow, the crowd looks, you know, they really played that song well, or the crowd looks into it. But there is just nothing that replaces that feeling of bringing a group of people together for that singular purpose of forming this basically temporary community, and all the things that come with that. But it's still, I still marvel at people who, at bands who can play the same songs for like 30 years. I think that level of performance, of being able to find something new in a song, having played it, especially like bands that have like hits that they're probably exhausted by, that crowds want. And I imagine that's just because they're finding that energy in the audience itself, not necessarily in the song.
Oh yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. And it is, it's an amazing thing when you get that energy back from the audience. I also think that even if you've been playing a song for a long time, there can be moments of discovery. In the same way that if you've been running in a show, I mean, I don't know about years and years and years, but I've had some, you know, fairly long, probably 6-8 months runs on a stage show. And just when you think that it's just by rote, all of a sudden something occurs to you and you know, you ask for the salt in a different kind of way, or, you know, whatever it is, or a laugh comes up that you've never had before. You know, it's the same thing with the music. Like, the audience reacts to something that you hadn't really considered, or you finally find a vocal lick that you'd been hadn't really occurred to you before. You know, I mean, stuff like that. So it can still be energizing. And when the audience is there and you're dancing and you're not stepping on each other's toes, it's really a nice feeling.
I mean, I would imagine the first shows back are going to be it's going to feel incredible. And I keep. You know, part of the hope that I keep hanging on to is that, like, gift wrapped in a bow at the end of this, when you can finally come out and be on stage and feel like I'm safe, the audience is safe, it's okay to be here. And the energy of that is probably going to be like, you won't even be able to describe it. But it'll probably be like unlike anything that we've experienced in recent memory in terms of performance.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
When you did tour, were you guys hitting the road for months at a time, or were you kind of just like jumping out, like, oh, we'll do a weekend here, a weekend here?
No, we would. Our last tour was probably, I guess, 3 months, maybe something like that. It was like 50 dates, I think.
Oh my God.
And I kind of, it's interesting. I mean, I really feel like, that I'm not sure about that so much working for me anymore. It's sort of like something that is really great when you're 19, you know,
right.
My age, but then a giant, you know, rock star who's like, you know, has his own bus or is moving in a plane or whatever, you know, 10 old guys crammed on the bus down to town. I think the bloom is off the rose a little bit. But the thing is that it's always in service. This is such a classic kind of, you know, the rock and roll statement, but it really is always in service of the time that you're on stage. And, you know, all the other stuff that you do, getting to the town and killing what seems like hour after hour after hour of waiting, going through sound checks, which can sometimes be fun but are usually pretty painful, you know. It's all in service of that, you know, that slot of time that you get to play. And it's the audience, but it's also just the feeling of making music with other people is just good. I mean, it's just good, you know. And so and with my brother, you know. I don't think I'm, you know, I'll have like a, you know, 200 date tour in my future.
And it's funny that the sort of how comedians and musicians just sort of peer over the fence at the other yard and go, it looks really cool over there. Cause you know, comedians will go, oh my God, you can play the same songs over and over and people ask for them, but you can only do bits like once or twice. And
right.
Then people are like, fuck you, I've already heard this. But then bands will go, yeah, but you just walk up on stage and it's just you and a microphone and that's it. And I do think about when I started bringing guitar with me, I was like, oh yeah, you gotta go in and do the, okay, more in the, all right, okay, less. All right, does that sound okay out there? You know, like you have to form a relationship with whoever the sound guy is every single night. It's like,
you don't carry a guitar tech. You tune your own guitar.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, especially because I feel like it'd be weird because, you know, I was mainly touring comedy clubs before everything because I'm building up a new hour. And I feel like it would be weird if I was in a comedy club with like 300 people and a guitar tech and a guy off to the side and like four guitars. That would feel like, what are you doing? It's not, come on, dude. What are you doing?
Speaking of live, my wife and I went to the Magic K Castle in Los Angeles and heard comedy from the car, which was really kind of fun. I mean,
Was it good? Because that I had friends who did a bunch of those shows and they were like, well, it's weird because people don't, you can't hear laughing, but they'll flash their lights and you hear honking.
Yeah. So. Well, they give you these plastic clackers that you can reach outside the window and smack them together. And you hear people like across, you know, kind of hooting and stuff like that. But the sound's coming on the radio.
Right. Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
But I loved it. I mean, I was like, we got out of the car, you know, we laughed a bunch. I mean, I would say the hardest part about it was that you're really pretty far away from the comic. So actually seeing their face, it was pretty far away, but it was still great, you know. And you have that shared experience within the car, you know, between the two of us, the things that we're finding funny or not, as the case may be. But it was great. I mean, it's one of those things where you go, do I want to be doing this forever? Would I rather be sitting in a club? Yes, I think I'd rather be sitting in a club, but in support of the art and support of the comics. And, you know, it was a fun thing.
This is what we had. That's what we have for now. Yeah. We didn't, I think it was probably 3 months into quarantine where we finally got takeout, where this is one restaurant that we used to go to all the time for date nights that had our credit card on file. So we'd drive up, they'd put the stuff in the trunk and we'd drive away. And so it was super safe. And that first night of that different food in the takeout was like, we just wanted to curl around the food because it felt, and it sort of feels like that too, just that need to sort of just be connected to the world or just do something that feels like, hey, this isn't ideal, but this is what we got. So this is going to be fucking great.
Yeah, totally.
Have you felt particularly creative in the last year? Like, have you been writing or doing stuff, or have you just been able to kind of shut down?
No, I have done a lot of stuff. Well, right out of the gate, I wrote a song called Corona Tune, and then I started to record it first with my own just kind of home situation. And then a friend of mine who lives down the street from us in California has a little studio, and he produced it with me, so we were able to mix down there wearing masks and everything in this, you know, just the two of us. My brother sent some cello parts.
Oh, wow.
And I put, you know, just I put layered my own vocals onto it. And then after that was done, my wife and I were back here on the East Coast, and I said, I'm trying to shoot this video. Will you help me with it? And because there's some shots that I can't really get of me, you know. And she was like, "Sure." So we took the iPhone out and a GoPro and started shooting it. And we, you know, I cut this video remotely with another friend of mine, put that video out. And she woke up and said, you know, we're sitting here, let's make a movie. So we made a movie, like a 10-minute short that she conceived, and we kind of wrote together, and then we directed each other in it. We lit it. We operated it. We did the hair and the makeup, the wardrobe sets, and the whole thing. And it was just the two of us. And that was really, really, that was great. So, you know, we're going to be in some festivals, and we finished with that. You know, so yeah, I mean, I think I'm pretty, even without the quarantine, I'm pretty one of those people that's pretty good at waking up and saying, oh, I want to try to do something. I mean, I think honestly that the, as much as I have sort of a love hate thing with it, social media has been fun because, you know, I've always taken the time to make silly little like videos and stuff and share them with my family and, you know, just kind of joke things. Now, you know, I can put them out. You know what I mean? It's like I'm basically doing the same thing that I've always done, but it just is on a, you know, a sort of a wider audience. Yeah, I tend to be someone that gets up and tries to figure out a job. I'm not somebody that wants to spend a lot of time on the couch. That being said, I also have said to people that there's a low level of trauma, I think, that we've all felt during this time.
Absolutely.
And it's not to be taken lightly. You know, this has been a real world tragedy, you know. Let's not forget how many people got sick and how many people died. And I think that living your life with that feeling that your life is at risk all the time is really hard to deal with. And there were days and still are days when I wake up and I just go, I can't think of anything to do. And I'm just going to find myself staring at the wall. And I think that's okay. I think we have to sort of let ourselves off the hook to a certain extent, because I know that early on in the pandemic, you know, everybody was talking about, who was it? You know, Shakespeare wrote Midsummer Night's Dream during a plague or something like that. Right. You know, that's what we should all be doing. And I think that you can have to tread lightly with that notion.
Yeah. Especially, you know, the thing you were talking about you just wake up some days and all you can do is stare at the wall. And I think the sort of allowing that and the acceptance of that and the sort of the mindfulness practice of being able to identify and say, well, this is how I'm feeling today. And that's going to be okay because things are fucked up and this is the best we can do. And also, you know, it's just that constant, like not knowing, you know, like we were so, at least we convinced ourselves, we were so certain, we had this kind of like false security bubble that, right. You know, that humans had for certainly our entire lives, you know, mm-hmm. and then it completely changes. And then you're like, oh, I guess it's, things aren't quite what I thought they were. And so there's the recalibration of like, well, what grounds me now and how do I find the center in a world that feels very chaotic at the moment? And you're right. I think some days you just have to be okay and go, I feel weird today. I feel sad today. And I just have to acknowledge that I feel that and know that it's okay without adding the extra pressure of like, why am I not writing a novel? Like just fucking, yeah. Just try to go easy. The world is rocky at the moment.
Definitely. Definitely. And I have to say that when I did get back to work, we shut down the second season of City on a Hill, two episodes in, and thinking, you know, well, we're just going to take a couple weeks off. Right. And, you know, that turned into whatever, 6 months. And then we went back. There was this strange feeling of going back into the world. Certainly a very bizarre situation when you show up on set and everyone's wearing, you know, PPE and there's face shields and masks and your temperature is checked and you've been tested and you're, you know, walking down a corridor and people are like clear the area. 'Cause the act coming through and all that kind of stuff, you know, but the feeling when the masks finally came off of the cast and we actually were shooting, there actually was film humming away in those machines. And when the, you know, you look over and you see a guy holding the boom and the operator is there and, you know, hair, makeup, wardrobe and the whole thing. It was so enriching. It was so, I felt so good to be back and doing it again. It's not like I was like, oh no, I can't do this. This is too weird. It was weird and it was great. And it was immediately clear to everybody, I think, that this was what we are meant to do, that this is what we're good at. You know, this is what we've spent our lives trying to do. And I'm not just talking about the cast. I'm talking about, you know, everybody across from catering to, you know, to director of photography. You know, it was a beautiful thing to see people back and working together, feeling hopeful. And also, to me, we lost one day with a positive case from somebody who had come outside. But when you really think about it, like the creation of that kind of a work environment in the middle of this thing should, in a lot of ways, be an example to the rest of the world that you can function if you really are very, very mindful of what you're doing and you really have the respect for the other people that you're working with to try to follow the rules. I mean, I think it's a good, I mean, I wish our entire country would have, you know, handled the pandemic in the way that like this film crew did, you know, because it went beyond just the shooting day. It included people making a conscious effort to be safe on the weekends so that, you know, when they came back to work, they were, you know, taking care of their fellow human beings in a pretty, you know, deep and important way. And that was very inspirational to me. I mean, when the season wrapped, I just remember looking around and thinking, boy, we should be really proud of ourselves.
Yeah, it definitely also is. It's sort of like that thing about when, you know, when you're younger and you don't get injured very often, but then you start to get older and it's like, oh, I just went to pick up a box and now I can't move my shoulder. And then your shoulder feels better and you just never appreciate not being in pain any more than like when it finally like goes away. And I think that appreciation of just sort of going through this trauma, and for a lot of people who have, you know, worked in a specific industry or job for so many years and maybe sort of, you know, even if you didn't take it for granted, even if you were just like, oh yeah, that thing, you know, it's yeah, acting or whatever, performing, it's fine. Then you get to do it again. And it just, this whole, like you said, this whole new level of appreciation, like, oh my, I'm lucky that I get to work. I'm lucky that I get to do what I do, especially now. And what an incredible experience. And so, you know, it's a horrific thing to be going, who have gone through, but seeing those moments of appreciation have been really enlightening. And hopefully we don't go back. You know, hopefully it's not that thing where in a year if things are normal, like, you know, we just start getting all whatever, cranky again about dumb little things. Like, I hope that we're able to continue to appreciate how special it is that we get to do what we do.
Yeah, me too.
So you finished shooting season two?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, we finished shooting season two, goes on in March and a couple weeks. And it's cool. I just watched the final episode today. It's great. I'm really, really proud of the season.
And do you already know what you're going to do next, or are you taking time?
I'm still thinking about that. I'm still, you know, looking at that. I don't really know. I mean, I went and did another movie right after we wrapped. I went down to Georgia and shot 3 days on a film with Machine Gun Kelly playing Machine Gun Kelly's dad. And that was great. It was a, you know, a cool kind of indie thriller. And it was good. My character on Sitting on a Hill is great character, but he's very, it's kind of consumptive playing him. You know, he's kind of so specific, and it's one of those guys that I don't always talk like this, but you kind of have to shake him a little bit.
Right.
And actually switching and doing this other man who was a very different sort of man, from a different world and et cetera, was something that was really great. It felt good, you know, and to remind myself that I can play more than one part. And so that was cool, but that's the only thing I've done since then.
This might be a weird question, but are you at a point now where in your career where you're just sort of like offers come in, or are there things that you chase after, or they're like, you don't audition for stuff anymore, I would imagine, at this point, right? People would just hire you, I would think.
Yeah, I haven't auditioned for a really, really, really long time. I honestly can't remember the last time I auditioned. That's not true, actually. I remember a story now. When Spielberg was making Jurassic Park, what was told to me was, you should read the book, and if you wanted to offer to say some of the dialogue out of the book, the offer wouldn't be turned down.
Okay.
So it wasn't technically an audition.
Right.
I read the book, read Jurassic Park, and, you know, found some little scenes where, you know, he had written out dialogue in the book, just like, but from the novel. And I said, hey, can I read some of this? And Steven was like, oh, okay, sure. So I think that was technically my last audition. I didn't get it, by the way, clearly. which is fine with me. I was talking to some actors the other day. We're saying, boy, you know, I really liked the audition. It really makes me, you know, I never liked it. It was never something that I looked forward to. But I know my wife, she likes it. She feels like it's a really good way for her. And she doesn't audition very much either, but she kind of feels like it's a good way to see if it's a good fit for her, you know, as well.
Right.
As being a good fit for them. My feeling is, if you can't tell from what I've done so far, if you're not sure from what I've done so far that I'm the right guy for the part, I probably don't want to work with you.
I feel like it was a dumb question when I asked him, because I'm like, what, Kevin Bacon, why would he audition? He's like, I've done hundreds of, yeah, exactly. It's like, so is someone going to go, I don't know, you know?
Here's the weird thing about it is that, you know, what you want to do when you go to work is you want to put yourself in the hands of someone who's going to make a lot of big decisions, and you want to trust that they're going to make these big decisions. So my feeling is, here's their first decision. Do they want me or not? That being said though, I don't sit back and just wait for a thing. I'm constantly thinking about, reading about things that are possible, talking to my people and saying, you know, can we see if there's anything in this project for me? I'm very proactive in my career. I love to meet with directors. I'm always looking at young directors' work. If I have heard about something, I will, you know, write and beg and, you know, reach out to people and, you know, say, I just would really like to do this. For the most part, these things haven't really led to anything, but once in a while, you know. And I think that, I don't audition mostly because I don't get asked to. That's the truth of the matter. I think that if I was getting asked to, I would all the time. I mean, I just would, you know, because I want to work. But I do stay, as I think it's important to stay active in your search for how you're going to create.
Yeah, but also it's the process is very strange because it's, and especially now because you know, in the old days you would have to like go into a room and there'd be a waiting room and you could hear everything that was going on in the room and that was weird. There was all this this mental steeplechase that you had to overcome that almost felt like it was a meta test. It was almost not even really about whether you could read the part convincingly, but did you have the metal to kind of jump through all these hoops and stay, you know, grounded? And I always hated that process. But now, like, you know, like my wife auditions all the time, but it's all done just, especially even this was happening before the pandemic, just on the iPhone. You just audition on the iPhone and you send it in. You don't have to go into an office anymore. It's changed the dynamic of people like, oh, maybe I don't have to live in LA anymore. I could just live wherever cheaper and send in auditions. But it's.
Yeah. The other thing that's cool about the self-tape is that you can do. I mean, I was talking to a buddy of mine the other day. He was trying to get this big movie. He told me he did 300 takes before he picked one.
Oh my God.
Send them in. He did it 300 times.
Oh my God.
And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? He said, yeah, man, it just wasn't quite right. And I wanted to send the right one in. And, you know, obviously in those days, unless the director or the casting director was nice enough to give you another shot, it was like a one shot deal. If you didn't do it in the first shot. Yeah. So, you know, listen, it is a different kind of world. My daughter's an actress, so I know the whole self-tape thing, and she'll send them sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes she'll send them and say, what do you think? Should I redo the second scene? And you know, it's interesting. It's just a different kind of connection that people make. And I know from, you know, I directed the first episode of City on a Hill, so we had a lot of casting to do to, you know, get the second season going. So I know from the other side too, is that you watch, you know, tape after tape after tape after tape. And it's actually difficult because I think for a lot of people, there's a pretty heavy level of multitasking that goes on these days. And, you know, if you were in an audition room, you certainly wouldn't be, unless you're a complete asshole, you know, checking your phone while you're looking at somebody's audition.
Right. Know? Right. Oh, so, yeah. But if you're watching on a computer, it's easy to get distracted. I mean, it's... Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. My wife just auditioned for something and the instruction that came through was like, if there's any noise in the background, if there's any distractions, we're just going to turn it off. And I was like, but what are you talking about? Like, it's where everyone's at home. Like, just, you know, like, I'm sure it's annoying. I'm sure, you know, a lot of people are getting weird tapes. But at the same time, it's like, I feel like everyone's kind of doing the best they can in the situation.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
But I think something that you said was really interesting for any performers in particularly, but that level of proactivity, you know, because I find that as many people as I've talked to, success and particularly an extended, you know, success that is sustained over time is rarely accidental, almost really never accidental, because I think, you know, it's easy to kind of, as young performers, get this very result-oriented thinking. We think, oh, if I just get a big movie, then everything's going to be easy and I won't have to audition or I won't have to do anything. And then I think it's easy. What you realize is like, no. You really have to do a lot of work consistently. It's not just your agent calling you and going, here's another $10 million offer. You know, you have to constantly give them material to work with. You have to look out for your own stuff and figure out who you are and what you want to do and, you know, chase things in some cases. So it's nice to hear that you say like, no, every day I'm still proactive about it. You can't be lazy about these things.
Definitely not. You know, there's been times in my life when I've, what? Sort of thought that I wanted to do that. Well, I'm just going to, you know, but the problem is that I don't look at the time between jobs as a vacation. There's certain times when we take a vacation, you know, we take a vacation between Christmas and New Year's. But the rest of the time, even if I'm not working, it's not vacation time. I'm in pursuit of the next thing, yeah. Or I'm trying to create something or generate something all on my own. I just am that kind of person that has to wake up every day and feel like what's my job going to be. And the hard thing, I think, that a lot of actors, especially young actors or people who are starting out really struggle with is, you know, if you're a guitar player, you can wake up every day and just, you know, sit in your room like Eddie Van Halen for 10 hours and, you know, keep trying to do those scales or whatever. If you're an actor, it's not an easy thing to practice. I don't even know. Do comics practice in their room by themselves or?
No, it doesn't work because you can't. And that's been sort of the conundrum during the for comedians is that, you know, I feel like comedy clubs they're a very tricky thing because, you know, comedy clubs are the ones that work the best are a little smaller. People have to kind of be cramped in, you're on a microphone that, you know, 1,000 other people have used, you know, there's like a lot of things about it, but like I have friends who've done Zoom shows and they're like, well, it's a different speed. And it sort of reminds you of when you were doing open mics and there were maybe two people in the room, but I just feel like, yeah, you can, the audience in your head might think something is funny. You never know until you get in front of people. You just, because it's a relationship that you form with the audience and they are required for 50% of it. You have to bring the stuff and then they have to bring whether or not they like it. So yeah, that part, there's just no substitution for that at all.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why I think that the being an actor, you know, I'm always trying to think of ways to practice being an actor. And there's two pieces of it. One is the practicing the acting piece. And the other is the, you know, trying to generate work piece, you know? So I try to do one of those two things every day.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than just a car or a house. It's the four wheels that get you where you're going and the four walls that welcome you home. When you combine auto and home insurance with Amica, we'll help protect it all. And the more you cover, the more you can save. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
Yeah, and even the other thing for actors too is that, I mean, if you're a stage actor, you to a degree you rely on the vibe of the audience. But if you go, well, I just really want to be a film and television actor, that is a really tough one to practice because how do you know if you're growing or doing a good job without a director or a teacher? Or like that level of self-reflection can be kind of difficult if you're just watching your own stuff and going, I think this is, I don't know. So yeah, I would imagine that is also challenging for people who only want to be actors because yeah, like you said, I don't know I have no idea how you practice that, you know, yeah. Alone. Do you feel at this point, are you driven at all by like, oh my God, what if I never work again? Or what if I like, do you still have some of those same, do those ever go away?
Always. I can't get past it. I really can't get past it. I mean, maybe I'm a little bit past it in degrees, but I always think that every job is my last job. I just do. Those memories of those days run so deep. It's a little crazy, I think. It's something that I, you know, have kind of tried to work on and tried to keep the wolf at bay in terms of those kinds of feelings that every you know, it's also a feeling that I'm not going to work again, and also that I'm going to be Emperor's New Clothes. You know, that I'm going to be sort of discovered as being a hacker, low rent.
Imposter syndrome.
Imposter syndrome. Yeah. Yeah, I do. I still feel that way. And now at my age, it's also a little bit shifted a little bit because then it also becomes this question of remaining relevant and interesting and for a guy vital and powerful and all these kinds of things are at risk. And I think that what I found is that when I get a character like Jackie Rohr on City on a Hill and some other things that I've done recently, I get to take those feelings and put those into those characters because sometimes the age that you're at is really nicely lining up with the things that you're being asked to play. And sometimes they're not, but sometimes they are. And I feel like at this point in my life, they kind of are. And if they're not, I can look at my own life and see if there's elements of that that I can put into the character. But to answer your question, yes, I'm literally right now thinking, okay, what's my next gig and where am I going to go? Is there going to be a script, coming my way? And I never think, oh good, I'm set.
Well, and half of that is probably good because it keeps you motivated, but the other half of that is like, how do you balance that and in a way that's healthy and not destructive? Because that sort of negative self-talk path is dangerous because you don't know. I feel like it's hard to know, like, well, is this a healthy fear that kind of keeps the fire going? Or is this just part of a ritual where every time I finish something, I have to go, well, that's probably the last thing, so that the next step is that I get to be pleasantly surprised. And now it's just a part of my like ritual. Like, well, if I have to follow these steps, you know, because it's just such an uncertain business.
But that's a very interesting question, though. I think that's a very interesting question that you're raising. I think in a lot of ways in this life, you have no one to blame but yourself in some ways, like if I feel unsure about the possibility of work, it's something that is created in a lot of ways by me, by choosing this very, very unstable line of employment, and never even considering doing anything else, it is a really interesting question. How much is it's kind of nature and nurture in a funny kind of way,
right? But the great thing about the uncertainty of it is that especially with this business is, you could have a few years where you feel like, nothing's really going on. I don't know what I'm doing. I feel out of sorts. And then all of a sudden you get some job that it's like, oh, I'll just do this fun thing for a couple of days. And then that turns out to be a thing that completely redefines, like, you really never know what gift is around the corner. And I think that's kind of the fun sort of, it's almost like antique shopping in a weird way where you're like, you might go to, 10 antique stores, but then you stumble across this one gem of a thing that no one else, and then you feel like your life has changed and you needed all those other times to get to that point.
Exactly. Well, and hand in hand with that is the fact that from the very beginning I was never a plan B kind of person. I thought I'm in this for the long haul, and once you make that kind of commitment that this is all you're going to do for the rest of your life, you sort of get a sense, or certainly for as long as I've been at it, of that there's going to be peaks and valleys, and there always have been. And sometimes the valleys last longer and sometimes the peaks last longer, but that's going to be the way it is, and when things feel really bad, both my wife and I, you know, sometimes we have to force ourselves to stop and say, okay, yeah, do we want to do anything else? Let's honestly ask ourselves, would we rather be, a philanthropist or a plumber or, a cowboy, I think this is what I'm kind of meant to be doing. And so then once you realize that, you can sort of keep plowing forward.
Yeah. But it also just kind of, you have this perfect balance of a career to me and from my vantage point, because the acting is uncertain. You have no control over that. You really have no control. Once you get on a set, all you can do is what you do on the day, and whatever happens after that has really nothing to do with you. And the balance of that is music. You can go pick up your guitar. You can go write songs. You can record. You can shoot a 10-minute film with your wife. Like, it is finding ways to kind of balance those two kind of disparate experiences, where you are a hired gun versus a creator. And you are a creator, an actor, but I mean, like, you create your own thing.
Right, totally. The band is completely our creation, and we wear our own clothes and we use our voices. We wrote the songs and we sing them. That is a nice outlet for the fact that as an actor, you really are time and time again putting yourself in the hands of a lot of other people in terms of what the end product is going to be.
Yeah, and even though you say like, well, I feel like I'm maxed out in terms of my guitar playing, are there still some guitar things that you want to do, or different things that you want to explore and songs that you're writing, or different styles?
Definitely. No, definitely. There are always things that I want to explore with the guitar. I mean, the reason that I started playing the guitar, honestly, was because I wanted to write songs. And so, like many people, I learned CGD and wrote a song with three chords. And then somebody showed me an E minor chord. And so the next song I wrote had a minor chord in it. And then that's what made me want to play that instrument, was just because I had melodic and lyrical kind of ideas, and I needed some kind of a tool to sort of structure them. It really wasn't about any kind of lead playing or I could do a little bit of finger style, but nothing really great. So to that end, when writing now, in rock and roll, there's not that many combinations really that ultimately you're going to do, but even so, I do like playing around with going places that I, melodically that I normally wouldn't necessarily hear. And if there's a lyric or a melody idea that I want to do, I'll push it to new places. I'll just say, I heard a reggae song, and let me see if I can write something in, with kind of like a reggae groove.
Yeah, because it's, again, and going down the YouTube rabbit hole, which also can be very intimidating.
Okay. Yeah.
They just go,
that's some amazing players out there, one after another, after another.
Yeah, that's not going to be like the guys that just, like, yeah. That's not going to be me, but it's still fun to know that with a very limited amount of space, like on a guitar fretboard, and a limited number of notes and a limited number of chords, there's still a tremendous amount of things that you can do that you could spend your whole life and still not do all of. So that, to me, like the endless possibilities of it, but it's just not talking myself out of it as you're like, fuck, I don't feel like this is getting any better.
I'm sure you've seen those things, have you ever seen those Shreds videos, Slash Shreds or Eddie Van Halen Shreds? They're basically, what it is, they'll take some iconic live.
They go, bloop, bloop, bloop.
just play like horrible stuff. It's the stupidest thing, but it's so funny to me. And so I took one of our performances. It was like a TV performance. And yeah. I went through, this is like too much time on my hands. I went through and did the whole band. And it was like a whole, it was like a time when we were sort of like going around and trading off solos and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it was so much fun. I just took the audio out and just built this horrible track. And what was so fun about it was, is that what the guys were playing, I could never in a million years play these things that they're playing. I mean, it's like, we have an amazing accordion player, you know? So I just took my harmonica and just kind of, you know, our guitar player, my brother, and, you know, just playing like, you know, it was a lot of fun.
I'm glad that you're still having fun, and I'm glad that you are able to, I mean, there's so much at our disposal to make stuff now that there's no excuse anymore. There's really very little excuse to, like, it's really just whether or not you feel like doing stuff.
Well, that's what I tell, you know, young actors. I mean, this is a different world that you're in now, because, you know, at some point, if you hang in there long enough, you're probably going to start thinking about wanting to generate your own material. And in this day and age, if you have this, just make yourself a movie. I mean, you know, why not? What's the worst can happen? And, you know, when you talk about being able to practice acting, it's a pretty good way to understand your craft. The first time that I ever saw dailies was during Footloose, and I begged Herbert Ross, who was the director, to let me come to dailies. And in those old days, they were all screened on 35 millimeter. After work, everybody would gather in a theater, and there usually be some pizza and beer and stuff, and the crew would sit there and watch. But actors were traditionally not allowed ever to go to dailies. It was just a thing. It's to this day, most directors don't want me or anybody else anywhere near the dailies. But Herb let me in. And so you'd see, you know, take after take after take. And it was such an amazing education for me, because I started to see that certain things that I thought I was doing, I wasn't doing. And I started to understand, if I had an idea of something that I wanted to put across on the screen, this was the way to do it.
Right.
And if you, as a young actor, now having a camera, you could do that. You know, it's like, you know, you can film yourself. You can get over that horrible feeling, like the first time you hear your outgoing message, you know, back in the 70s, let your message. Well, when you look at yourself in a movie on the premiere night, you multiply that outgoing message by like a million, you know, and here's your face and here's your body and here's your voice and your movement and all. But if there's a way to kind of learn that, temper that technique, I think people should make their own movies whenever they can.
And you were okay watching the dailies for Footloose? Because I feel like a lot of directors don't want actors to watch because of performers, like, weird vanities about things, like, oh, my chin looks weird in that, or oh, why'd you use that? And then it just sort of adds like a headaches for the director. So were you able to watch it a little more objectively and be cool with it?
Yeah, I mean, listen, that's exactly the reason why, you know, directors, I mean, there's plenty of stories about, you know, somebody starts out with a character, and then halfway through they see their dailies and they come back with a French accent. I mean, you know, or like they're wearing a big bump or something. I don't know. You know, yeah. Listen, it's there is a risk factor there for sure, because we're not always super objective about our own work. That being said, I wasn't really in a position to make any changes. You know, he was, right. He was in the power position. There were plenty of producers who were way more powerful than me. And I knew that was the risk, because I knew that, I remember on Diner, Barry Levinson wouldn't let us watch any dailies. I snuck in one time to the editing room and just kind of looked over this guy's shoulder. But, I knew that if I said, hey, you know, I think I should change this, or, hey, you know what, I think you should use take number four. I could tell that that was not going to be cool, that that was going to knock me out of it. So I just basically sat there and listened and watched everything. I'm not talking about my performances. I watched like second unit, you know, doing like, you know, whatever shots of things that, you know, people inserts of somebody just like picking up a cup. I just wanted to learn about film, and it was really very educational.
As a director, would you let your actors watch dailies?
It wouldn't be my first choice. But on the other hand, if somebody really felt that they, that it was important to them, that it could give them, you know, a lot of actors don't really ask or they don't really want to. Some people are horrified by it, you know.
Right. For that very reason, because they don't want, you know, the guy, Andy Lincoln, who starred in Walking Dead for many years, would never watch the series because he was afraid that it would affect his performance. So a lot of people are very, a lot of performers are aware of that sort of thing. But I almost feel like as a director, you'd have to be like, okay, I'll let you watch it. Just don't get weird. Just try to see it objectively, you know. Yeah.
The other piece of that is, which is exactly what you're referring to, is that, you know, as a director, directing is a very, very vulnerable thing to do. You have to really front all the time that you know exactly what's going on and that you're right. doing a good job and that you're taking good care of your actors. Right. And if somebody sees something, and let's say they really don't like the way they look in a particular shot, but you really had no intention of using that moment for that shot, you know, it was only for when, you know, they turn around and walk away or, you know, whatever it happens to be, you're setting yourself up to be, you know, criticized. So I understand why directors are reticent to do it. You know, what I do mostly now, just because it's not, I'm not quite as sort of adamant about it anymore, is I just want to see, you know, a scene and just right. see if I feel like I'm kind of on the right track, that I'm, you know, that I'm in the pocket, or if I'm making any kind of giant mistakes. It's not a way. I know how hard it is to be a director, and I know there's a really long journey between the dailies and the movie.
Right.
And there's a lot of shit that goes down in between the in between those two iterations of the film. So, you know, that's I don't put a lot of pressure on people anymore in terms of that.
Well, that's good. And again, you never know. Like this thing that you made with your wife, that could end up being like the next, like you could get some huge thing out of that, you know? It's like, oh, now you guys have to, like, you just don't know this thing that you just made because you were like, why, we're just sitting around. Why don't we just do this fun thing, you know, that she said we should do. And you listened, which was good. Now who knows what that could become. And not that it matters if it does either way.
It's going to be huge. Let me tell you, it's going to be huge. It's going to be the biggest 10-minute movie made in somebody's backyard that's ever been made.
But you never know. And, you know, what's fun about that is the intimacy of it. And it almost seems like that, like the purity of y'all doing that is there. That's where the kind of the magic lives. Because let's say a big studio came to you, like, we're going to give you $10 million. Go make a thing. Of course you could do that. And of course that would be great. But it also, there's a lot of business stuff that would kind of get in the way, where this was just something that was fun. You just made it because you could, and you had the time, and, you know, like being able to remember, like, well, this is what it's about. It's just making stuff because we like to make stuff, not for all these other reasons that we use to kind of judge or kind of figure out where we are for our own egos, our place in the business or whatever. And I think it's amazing that you guys did that. Can people see that anywhere yet? Or you said it's going to go.
Not yet, but very soon we are going to be in some festivals and you know, by the spring, it'll be available. And yeah, we're really happy with it. It's, you know, it kind of, it's not about a pandemic, but it certainly is creatively a reaction to what we were feeling being in isolation and looking at the world and looking at the loss that people were dealing with every day. That's what it kind of came out of. So it's definitely a lockdown movie.
Well, but that, you know, like I don't sound like a douchebag, but that's art, you know. It's like you're basically re-expressing some emotional experiences that you had, and that's the sort of the purity of art. So I think it's great that you did it. I think it's great for people to know, because I'm sure that particularly young performers make a lot of assumptions about people that they look at and go, that's that person's so successful, they probably don't have to do X, Y, or Z, or they probably don't feel X, Y, or Z like I do. And I think it's refreshing for people to know that, like, yeah, you do. And that's just a thing. And, you know, and no one job or anything is ever going to, quote, fix you. You just got to kind of enjoy the process of it and keep making stuff that's important to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Before we wrap this up, because you've been very generous with your time, and if the answer is no, it's totally fine. Is there just one thing you could show me on guitar? Is there one, like, a thing that you go back to, or a thing that kind of changed your perception, or just like something, just anything? Can you just give me one guitar tip?
A tip? Well, I'm not convinced that I play any better than you do.
I'm convinced that you play better than I do.
Let's see. The funniest one I wish that I could do. The one I wish I really could do, but I can't really do it anymore. Somebody said there was some note. It was a trick where you played five E's or five G's or something like that. It was like this whole kind of thing where you had to do it like this, and then you had to play with the other finger, but I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, that seems hard. That seems way outside my skill set. Is there a scale that you like, or an inversion that you like?
Tell you about this was the James Taylor D thing. So his D is like this. I can't even do it.
Oh, I see. He's using the three stronger fingers because he's doing all the hammer-ons and pull-offs in there on the D. Yeah.
So in other words, normally your index fingers is on top, right?
Yeah.
But then his is flipped around like this. So it's kind of hard to play because you have to get your wrist all the way. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, no, I totally see that. And he also does the thing. I've watched him, because I think he released an album recently, or he released a book or something. But he also has this insane, what I imagine is a like press-on nails that he uses as pick, because he does all that folk-style, like, finger-picking shit.
Yes, yes. I don't know. That's all I like.
The James Taylor D is good. I'm gonna research it and see if it's possible. And even in the trying to learn it, maybe I'll have some kind of a breakthrough.
Yeah, that's my one tiny little tip for the day.
I appreciate it. Kevin Bacon, you've always been nothing short of delightful, you know, every time you've come on, and I really just appreciate it.
Always fun to talk to you, man. Always fun to talk to you.
I appreciate that, and I hope you all stay safe and healthy. And
thank you. Same to you.
We'll see you sometime in the. I almost want to say in the new year, because exactly. I'm almost looking at like the world opening back up as the line of demarcation for the new year.
That's what it feels like, though, right? That's what it feels like. We're all looking for a new year. I think we were looking for a new year from 2020, and then it didn't quite turn into one.
And now we're just like, okay, what about now? Is now okay? Now? And,
yeah, you know, now. Like, now
it's
opening
it back up, and it's like, okay, everyone, don't get crazy. It's like, it's nice, it's good. Don't get fucking crazy. Like, we just want to, like, let's just ease back into this. Let's make this okay.
But all right, man. Great to see you.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. Bye.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.